Okay, so welcome back. Today's class number 45. And today we're going to pick a topic, which I think is one of the main topics of the book, called the Split Kingdom and the reason for it. Why is it a main topic? Because if you know Sefer Melachim, we're always going back between the King of Yehuda and the King of Israel, the King of Yehuda and King of Israel. And even though it begins with the United Kingdom with Shlomo, right after Shlomo, the kingdom splits with Rehoboam and Yerovam, and that split kingdom continues almost to the end. And when the northern tribes are finally exiled, so the last, 80 years, we have just Judea, but the tribes from the north come down. But one of the main topics is the split kingdom, and we'll see how it's going to relate to pretty much one of the main topics of the book, is what's the reason for the destruction. Okay, so today I want to talk about what causes the split kingdom and the idea behind it. And the main thing we're talking about, what I call when politics and religion clash, there's going to be a religious reason for the split kingdom. There'll be a political reason, and we'll see how they're connected. I'll give you an example before we start of what I'm getting at. It's called dual causation, I think, in fancy English. Meaning, when David HaMelech sinned, in the famous Bathsheba story, when we did the middle section in Sefer Shmuel Bet, from chapters 9 to 20, we talked about the religious reason for David losing so many children and the revolt of Absalom, etc. It was all a result of David's sin with Bathsheba. But David's sin with Bathsheba caused a political vacuum, which led to Absalom's revolt and led to Amnon and Tamar and his children not listening to him, and led to people thinking he can't run the country anymore. So the when the king, who was once really big and strong, the people begin to see he's not acting properly, so that leads other people to try to take the kingdom. So the religious reason for sin with Bathsheba also led to a political reason, David's passivity, and therefore the two reasons were sort of connected. We discussed that in detail when we did Sefer Shmuel. We'll see something similar now with Shlomo, with the sin with the foreign wives and Yerovam's revolt. There'll be a political connection and a religious reason for it. Okay, that was my stall, and now we'll get started. So I'll share my screen. The main source we need today is pretty much the Tanakh. We'll do a lot of psukim, but I'll try to frame it from the perspective of the entire book of what's going on. There's a more general question, which the main thing I want to focus on in the middle of this year, is the split kingdom is clearly started by a Navi. Was this God's original plan, or was this because of a mistake? I'll give you a really bad, maybe a better good example. Was God's original plan to have only the first luchot without midat rachamim? Remember, in Sefer Shmot, was God's original plan to have the first luchot, but because we sin with chet ha'egel, we got the second luchot, and otherwise we wouldn't have midat rachamim. We'd have a whole different relationship with God. But I take it back. You'll understand why. Was God's original plan to have creation without any laws? Then came the flood. And then God decided, we need the Noahite laws. Or then we need, in other words, was God's original plan only to have, not to have basically the story of Chumash, but because of the sin of the flood, everything changed? Or was that God's original plan, but I need the story of the flood to appreciate what we have after the flood?
Also, you could say, was it God's original plan to have just Adam 1?
That was my next line. Okay, was God's original plan for Elvis to be in Gan Eden without ever leaving Gan Eden and never dying and things like that? Or they need the story of Gan Eden to appreciate life outside Gan Eden? If you're catching the pattern, what's going on in Chumash? Hope you're catching on. And I want to use that same analogy. Was God's original plan for Malchut David to be the only Melucha from the very beginning, and because Shlomo sinned, it fell apart? Or was that bound to happen, and God wanted, I wouldn't say a split kingdom, I'll just spill the beans. What I want to claim is God wanted a shared kingdom, and it could have been a shared kingdom, but what went wrong was what should have been a shared kingdom became a split kingdom. But there's an advantage of having a shared kingdom, and that's what we're going to talk about later today. And was this bound to happen? Okay. I'm not sure if that's right, but I'm simply using the pattern that happens so often before Hanu Chumash, even the Melucha beginning with Shaul and then going to David. Had Shaul not sinned, we would never gotten to Malchut David, or I needed Shaul's kingdom to get to David. There's a pattern going on over and over again, not just in Chumash, just in all of Tanakh, where I think they call it thesis, antithesis, synthesis, where I'm presenting something and then breaking it and then putting it all together. And then we have what pretty much God wanted in the first place, but I needed to go through those stages to get there. We call it adolescence if I want to compare it to humans growing up, but that's a different class. Now, let's get to work and see what I'm getting at. Again, I'm not sure if my approach is right, but I want to present it today and see how it goes. Let's go with my shared screen and we'll talk about Yeroboam's revolt. And what I want to begin with, just a review of this sine wave we talked about last week. Without going into the thing we talked about last week, I just want to show you, remember, if the y-axis are the high points, and when things are ideal, let me get my little highlighter. If this is the ideal points like this, what's going to cause, oh, that's not good. What's going to cause the downfall is going to be Yeroboam's revolt. Then we want this. Because the downfall starts with Yeroboam's revolt. The worst is this terrible civil war between Asa and Baasha we'll get to probably in a week or two. The country's good again when we're united with Ahab and Yehoshaphat, but the kingdom split again without unity with Yehu's revolt leads to, again, terrible civil war in the time of Amatziah. Watch, it's like really bad in that time period. Things recover when Uzziah and Jeroboam work together, and things fall apart again when Ashur comes in, and then the 10 tribes are already gone, and then we have recovery, but that's already not a question of a split kingdom. That's a question of if there's any kingdom left. That's the topic of the end of Sefer Melachim. But if you look at when are things good in Jewish history, when we're united, things are good. And when we're split, things are bad. Now, the other reason I could say when there's no superpower in the Middle East, things are good. And when there's a superpower, we're bad. Or what allows the superpower to come and take over is our lack of unity. We'll see that happening with Shlomo coming up. In other words, what's the cause and what's the effect? That's why I'd like to use this graph. If you're an investment banker, which I'm not, but you see them with all these graphs, you're studying graphs of how the market's going up and down, and you're trying to figure out what causes the market to go down and what causes the market to go up. And if I can figure out what's the cause, as opposed to what's the result, if I can figure out what's the cause of the up and what's the cause of the fall, then I know how to make a hedge fund and support yeshivot. Okay. So anyway, that's my little analogy. Therefore, I want to focus on today on Yeroboam's revolt, this one over here, because that's going to begin the first fall from our high point that we talked about in the first couple of shiurim on Malachim of how great things were and what's going to cause them to fall apart. So let's go back now to, I'm sorry, share my screen again and go back to our source sheet. I want to jump to the middle of the story about Yeroboam's revolt because sort of a new topic starts here, and we have to work backwards from here. There's a parsha in the middle of chapter 11, which introduces Yeroboam. Okay? It says, Yeroboam ben Nevat Hefratim in Yeroboam is from the tribe of Ephraim, which is from that house of Yosef. Remember, Ephraim and Menasheh are from Yosef. And Yosef had a leadership role. Remember, the two big blessings that Yaakov gives his children, there's leadership of Yosef, and there's leadership of Yehuda. And that's a topic that began back in Sefer Bereshit. And it's not by chance. One is the Bechor, or the leader from Leah, from the house of Leah, one from the house of Yehuda. From Yehuda, we get David. And from Yosef, we get to Ephraim, we get to Yeroboam. Now, in Sefer Bereshit, was it a question, who's the leader, Yehuda or Yosef? Or did God want Yehuda and Yosef sort of to work together in leadership? And the same thing, and it goes back to a bigger question. The fact that Yaakov had two wives, Leah and Rachel, was that again a comedy of errors because Laban was able to trick him? Or was that something that God wanted to happen? What's the reason why Yaakov in the end has to have two wives, Leah and Rachel, and why the rivalry between the brothers? What I want to get at, in this rivalry between having 12 tribes and having two leadership tribes among the 12 tribes, is that something which is just a cause for concern and trouble? Or does that have potential for greatness? And that's something ideal if it works right. And we're going to go in that direction as the Shir goes on. So again, Yeroboam is from Ephraim. We get his mother. We introduce every king with knowing who their mother was. Usually the mother of the king, called the queen mother, was an important person in every kingdom. And notice, His mother was an Isha Almanah, I mean, someone growing up from a poor home. And he's an Evet to Shlomo. Doesn't mean he's a slave to Shlomo. Means he's working. He's in the service of Shlomo. And what does he do? Vayera Miad B'melech, he revolts against the king. It's not a revolt from an outsider. It's a revolt from an insider. Someone working for the government. Someone in the government working for Shlomo, dedicated to Shlomo, is going to start a revolt. Now, we're going to get to the revolt in a minute. Pasuk Chavchet really should be the first verse. Why it's out of order, maybe we'll talk about. But all the Parshanim, almost all the Parshanim, say Pasuk Chavchet comes first. It's sort of like a footnote to the first two. We'll talk about the revolt in a minute. But first, let's see who Yerovam was. We're going to skip to Pasuk Chavchet. Va'ish Yerovam Gibor Chayim. Now, the Navi isn't telling us that he's a male and not a female. Remember, Ish means he's a man, like Kulam Anashim, or Shlach Lecha Anashim means important people. He's a person with leadership abilities. He's a Gibor Chayil, means it could be he's either a good soldier or simply a multitasker, like Megillat Rut. Boaz was Ish Gibor Chayil as well. Chayil doesn't only mean army, it also means wealth, basically multitasker, like an Eshet Chayil, someone who can do a lot of things. But Yerovam was basically a big shot, had leadership qualities and wealthy and strong. Shlomo saw his abilities. Vayar Shlomo et ha'nar, ki oseh melachahu. He's a good worker, he gets the job done, etc. Vayefked oto l'chol sevel beit Yosef. Now, someone tell me what the word sevel sounds like. Take a quick break. See the word sevel?
Suffering. Suffering.
What?
Suffering.
Suffering. Okay, now, in modern day Hebrew, what do you call the guy who carries your bags, like when you're moving your house? What do you call the guy who carries the refrigerator?
Sabal.
That's called a sabal. Why is he called a sabal?
It bears a heavy weight. He has to
He's
slap
carrying
it.
a heavy load. Now, what does it mean he's in charge of the, is it not, it's not really suffering here. It's called labor. There's a labor, there's what's called like a Teamsters union, I think, and people in charge of the workers group. There's a workers union who work very hard. It's very easy to take advantage of people like that, and you need someone in charge of them. Now, who's ever running the labor group? Either he has to identify with his workers or with the employer. Is the head of the Teamsters union, is he getting paid? Is he getting kickbacks from the person? The employer or from the employers? You follow? And yes, and if he's smart, he plays both of them against each other. Then later he becomes king or becomes a big shot. But in general, it's really important that someone has to be in charge of your workers because you need workers and you want them to control them. Shlomo doesn't want to do it himself. He's looking for an insider to be in charge of them. So,
Isn't the name of Yerovam's mother ominous? Sarua, she's going to drive him from the camp.
Oh, her name, let me take a look at that again. You want to say there's wordplay in her name? That's always a big question. Are the names of secondary characters in Tanakh have a deeper meaning sometimes? And you're saying,
Sarua
Sarua sounds something, Sarah.
is
It's
Sarah.
like Sarah, and she's an Isha Manah. That's a question why she's called Sarua. Maybe she had Sarah when she was younger or something, but why you would call your daughter, why anyone would name their daughter Sarua, if it means Sarat, that's a big question. But
But he,
I'm not sure what the etymology of the name is.
but he, but Yerovam left the camp in the same way as a person with Tzara'at has to leave the camp.
Sent away. Well, we'll talk about that when we get to. Actually, we're going to go backwards and see what happened earlier in the chapter. We'll talk about that very soon. Anyway, what does he do? Basically, he is a member of the House of Yosef. He's a natural leader among the House of Yosef, and he knows how to employ his workers. Shlomo appoints him to be in charge, and therefore he's an insider with Shlomo, and Shlomo put him in charge of Kol Sevel Beit Yosef, of the task force of workers of Beit Yosef. Now, what work are they doing? We'll talk about. We have to go backwards and figure out what work they're doing and how this relates to Shlomo's building projects. Okay. Now, what was his revolt? Zan davar asher harim yad b'melech. This was the revolt. When Shlomo built the Milo, which is a big argument, what is the Milo? Well, maybe we have time to talk about the archaeology about it. We'll go back and see where this pasuk is coming from. When Shlomo built the Milo, he closed up the opening of Ir David. What's Peretz Ir David? What opening is there? Now, why is this wordplay? Peretz Ir David. That's an easy one. What's Peretz have to do with David?
The sister of the...
His ancestor.
David's from Peretz. Now, remember, did we see this word a lot? When they brought the Aron back, when David brought the Aron to Yerushalayim, remember? Remember Peretz Uzzah? That's the floats ahead, but why is it called Peretz Ir David? Is this an opening? There's something happening there. I'll give you the background to the archaeology, the way it's usually explained. There might be other explanations, but in fact, there was just an article that came out today in today's news. They found this amazing find in Jerusalem in what's called Chenyon Givati, which is the area between the upper city and Ir David. They found an amazing moat. That was man-made, dug between the upper city and the lower city from the time of Bayit Rishon, which is like their notes from first temple period, we're not exactly who built it, but definitely during the first monarchy, which was an amazing building feat. The Mamash, they moved the mountain around and they made this giant moat. And some people want to relate this again to Peretz Ir David. But there's these massive building projects taking place as Jerusalem's expanding from the city of David north to Har Abayit. Now, most of you, I'm sure, have been to Israel and been to Jerusalem, and you know the Southern Wall excavations. Almost everyone's been there. You go from the Kotel, you go right down there. And then you've been to Ir David. Now, Ir David is low down, but it's a little mountain. It's a small mountain. It has a great water source, the Gihon, and later that moves to the Shiloh. Ir David was sort of the capital city in the very beginning of Bayit Rishon, where David built his capital. That's where the water is. That's where all the official places are. Later, the city moves to the upper hill, where Har Zion and the Jewish quarter is today. But the Jerusalem, the capital city, begins in Ir David, where the water source is. And the temple is built north of Ir David on a hill called Har Abayit. Between Har Abayit and Ir David is a valley. And most people say that valley is a type of there's a valley in between them. But if you know the excavations there, there's, I think, 13 levels of excavations in the valley between Ir David and Har Abayit, which is the Southern Wall excavations. Why are there so many? Because you have a big natural valley between the city of David and the Temple Mount. And as the city's growing and expanding, you keep on filling up that level and building in between. And we're going to see when it could be that the Milo, the Peretz Ir David, might be the opening between Ir David and the Temple Mount. The Milo is the area filled up to build it. Actually, maybe just go back to it. I'll just go there right now. In Shlomo's building projects, it's at the end of the source sheet. Let me just jump ahead there to see what I'm talking about. In chapter, where are we? In chapter 9, I think it's chapter 9, if I'm not mistaken. In Shlomo's building projects, let's see what Shlomo builds. This is back in chapter 9. Hiram sends all the lumber from Lebanon. Then Lebanon and Israel were getting along very well together. Hiram sends to Shlomo, how much? 120 kikar zahav. And just to get an idea of the wealth, who remembers how much gold was collected to build the Mishkan? Any members, Parsha Pekudei? You all know that Kesef was 100 kikar, remember? Mea kikar, there was 100 kikar of silver. There's 29 kikar of gold. And then you can check out Parsha Pekudei later on, for sure, chapter 38 in Sefer Shemot. Just to get an idea, here's 120 kikar kesef. So it's a lot. We'll see a bigger amount coming up later. Remember the numbers. To build the Mishkan was 29 kikar. This is 120 coming from Lebanon, just in trade. Now, Zedro Hamas Asher Allah Melech Shlomo. This is the tax that Shlomo collected from the people. Now, we think of mas as a financial tax, correct? Which it is. For building projects, you have to collect money. But what else do you need for building projects? You need workers. So is mas a financial tax? Or is it like miluim, is it a workers tax? Now, do you need to give money for Shlomo's building projects? Or do you need workers? We'll see that coming up. Remember, we'll see later on in chapter 12, who gets stoned?
Adoniram.
Ram Asher Alamas. The tax collector came from Rechavam to collect money from Dafka and Shechem, remember? And he got stoned and pelted, and remember, he got killed. He got, because he was a tax collector. But was he coming to collect workers or money? We'll talk about that soon. Listen to the building projects, which is key to understanding the political background to the revolt. Okay. What was the building projects? Beit Hashem. Oh, everyone wants to do that. Building a house for God, that's great. That was, everyone's going to donate. If you're in a new community and they're building a new shul, everyone's going to donate because you want a nice shul or starting a break, whatever you're doing. But raising money for shul, people are behind it. Bet Bitol for the king's palace. Okay. I want my king to have a nice palace. If you live in London, if you live in England, you would agree to that. In America, maybe a little bit less. In Israel, if money is, if the prime minister is spending money fixing up his house, half the country's demonstrating because why does he need a special, like, it depends how pro and anti-kingdom you are. Okay. So one building project was the king, was the house for God, a house for the king, the palace of the king, and the Milo was a big building project. Got that? So what led to the revolt was the Milo that Shlomo's building. Right? That's building project number three. Got it? That's building project number one had a lot of support, Beit Hashem. Beit HaMelech, the king's own house and palace, also had support. When Shlomo builds the Milo, that's going to lead to the revolt. Understand what's happening? No. And also he built Chomat Yerushalayim, which probably people know that's necessary. And the three big cities, which was Yigal Yadin's big, you know, archaeological discovery, three big cities, Hatzor, up north in the Galilee, in the Megiddo, in the lower Galilee, you know, in Gezer, near Shalavim, those are three big fortress cities, and they all have the same gate, called the gate we have, each side has three entry places on it. I forget the fancy name for it, but if you visit Megiddo, it's one of the first things you see entering Megiddo. You have the same archaeological setup in Chazor and Gezer, and Yigal Yadin dug up all three of them and claimed they're all from the time of Shlomo, and that was one of his big finds, and anyone who does archaeology in Israel always takes this pasuk about these are Shlomo's massive building projects. Are they, there's a big argument, are they from Shlomo or from Achab, but it's pretty much understood today they're from the time of Shlomo. Now, but these are all the big things. But the one that caused the revolt was the Milo. But we don't know what the Milo is. Now, who helped him fund this? Paro, remember, who Shlomo married his daughter, okay? Earlier had taken Gezer. Remember, that's one of the three cities. And took it over. And he gave it as a present to his daughter who married Shlomo. He said, Shlomo, got it? So Gezer was a freebie. But the other cities Shlomo built himself. Again, Megiddo is really important strategically. And so is Chazor. Okay. And Shlomo builds up all these different cities. We'll skip all these psukim. And who is his workforce? See, look how nothing's changed. Okay. Kol ha'am hanotar. I'm sorry. These are the storage cities he built. Cities for Arei HaRechev, for the horses, like Megiddo. Arei Parshim for the chariots, etc. Everything Shlomo built in Yerushalayim and from Lebanon, basically under his kingdom. Who did all the building? Kol ha'am hanotar min ha'mori achiti v'aprizi. There's a local population who wasn't conquered. I mean, was maybe conquered, but wasn't driven out. Who remained, who survived from the seven nations. Asher lo mivnei Yisrahema. The non-Jewish people in the country that we captured, they remained alive. They lived among us. We were now sovereign. Okay. B'nehem asher natru achrem ba'aretz. Asher lo yichlu b'nei Yisrael achrimam. We weren't able to wipe them out altogether. Now, Adayom Hazeh is Natan. Got it? Remember this, maybe Natan or Achriah Shiloni, he's writing this section. But when this section was written, it's not Adayom Hazeh from the time of Yirmiyahu at the end of Bait Rishon. Adayom Hazeh is from the time of Shlomo or maybe Yerovam, Rehavam, this time period, when this section is being written, remember it's incorporated by Yirmiyahu into Sefer Melachim. We talked about this in an earlier shiurim, but when this section was written, they were still the foreign workers were still doing all the manual labor. Now, in the original building, listen carefully. In the early building projects of Shlomo, who does the manual labor? Okay, the local population who were not part of Israel but remained Remember? The children of people, we didn't wipe out. The local population, the non-Jewish population, did the manual labor. And the Jewish people did what? They were the big shots. They were officers in the army. They were the people, taskmasters, etc. You follow the, does that sound familiar? And almost, not just in Israel, in almost every country. There's the main population running the country, and the immigrants and the migrants or the people who were captured, taken over, doing the cheap manual labor, which always can lead ultimately later to some problem. Now, in these building projects, you have, you know, when you're starting off, you have lots of labor. As you start growing more and more, there's a labor shortage. And what's going to happen? You're going to have to start taking taxes, not just from, not just financial taxes. You're going to need more workers when you have these big building projects. We'll see why in a minute. Now, we talked about serving Sibim Bolivar Malone, who in charge of, there's people that were in charge of every 50, had someone in charge of every 500. Harodim Baum, they're in charge of the people. We're doing the work. Now, listen carefully. Ach bat paro al tamir David al betasher banala az banach et avilo. Now we have an important information about the Milo. When did Shlomo build the Milo? When Shlomo married Bat Paro, Shlomo was living near David with his palace. He built, I call it an embassy for Bat Paro, a temporary one in near David when they first got married. And then part of his building project was a house for Bat Paro in the Milo. Meaning what? Because Shlomo marries all these foreign wives, I told you foreign wives is not, it's not that he wants, so he doesn't need so many wives, you follow? Marrying the daughter of another king is a political relationship. It's having a treaty. The thing between England and France happened all the time. All the countries in Europe did it. But it means I need an embassy for the queen. And who's Bat Paro in charge of? If you have all these big building projects and all this trade and all these horses coming from Egypt, I have Egyptian dignitaries coming to Israel. I have Egyptian engineers and architects coming to Israel. They know how to build in Egypt. We visited the pyramids. You have military people, people in charge of training horses. Instead of the people being agricultural and most of the people living basically at home, you know, living with agriculture in their nachala, all of a sudden the nature of society is changing. And we have professionals and we have architects and workers, and we're going to have shipping. And sea routes, we're gonna have a route all the way down to Eilat. We'll see soon. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Which means day-to-day life in Israel changes tremendously. There's massive building projects going on, but they require a lot of funding. And when you're funding a temple, fine. When you're funding a house for the king, okay. When you're funding a building project to build embassies for all your foreign wives, enough is enough. Hope you're following where we're going. The Milo project has a lot to do with Shlomo's many wives. But Shlomo's many wives is not just, oh, he wants palaces for his wives because he's like Ahasuerus, who wants all these women in his palace. It's not because he has a harem. Shlomo's many wives is his political growth and treaties with other nations. He's building embassies for the foreign nations, and that's how Israel's growing leaps and bounds. But to make them happy, but for international reasons, I need to build a serious palace. And therefore, the Milo project is basically making Jerusalem an international cosmopolitan city. So all these building projects, we're seeing, going to take almost like some 20 years. Remember, there's 7 years to build God's house, 13 years for his house. We'll go back. We saw that earlier in chapters 6 and 7. The people don't mind the taxation and the extra work for the first set of projects. When it keeps on going on and on for decades now, it's going to start a workers' revolt. So when Shlomo builds the Milo, now we go back to, I'll just skip to the naval, he sets up, the shipping fleet. Ani means the shipping fleet. Shlomo does in Etzion Gaber, that's a lot, which is by, it says there a lot. Asfat Yamsuf, Beretz Edom, okay? And Hiram sends, what do you call it? Workers to build ships. Remember in Lebanon, they know how to build ships as well because they're shipping in the Mediterranean. He has his Mediterranean shipbuilders, sends them down to Eilat. They're saying Yodei HaYam. It's a great saying. People who know the sea with Shlomo's builders, with his Lebanese builders. They go all the way to Ophira, that's Sharm el-Sheikh. all the way down south. They take their gold. And how much gold do they bring from there? 400 versim kikar, 420 kikar kasef. That's three times more than we had before from Lebanon. And that's part of Shlomo's great wealth. But that's a lot of work and a lot of building. What I'm trying to show is that there's a change in society due to industrialization. Got that? And sometime along this great industrialization, the people blow the whistle and say enough is enough. If I go back now to opening lines, which were almost cryptic in the beginning. So what happened? What was, remember, Yerubam was in charge of the workers of Sevel Beit Yosef. Remember, after all that work, people start suffering, all this extra miluim, all this extra work they're doing. And what was the revolt? When Shlomo built the Milo and closed the opening of Ir David, what happened? That's what led to the revolt. It's a workers' revolt. Now, what led to the workers' revolt? All of Shlomo's building projects for who? For his many wives. Now, what's the religious? Now, that's the political reason for the revolt. You got it? I hope you're catching on. What's the religious reason for the revolt? If we go back, remember, Shlomo married too many wives. We'll go back. That's going to be chapter. I got everything out of order here. That's going to be in chapter. That's chapter. Did I skip that? That's the beginning of chapter 11. I skipped that. No, I skipped that. I'll open up a regular talk for a minute, make sure people are following. Here. If I go back to chapter 11, I'm not sure why it's not here, but I'm probably on my source sheet, I just couldn't find it. If I open up chapter 11, here. V'amelech Shlomo hav nashim nachriyot. Where are we? Make it bigger. Plus, plus, plus. Okay. Including Bat Paro. These are all the four nations he has relations with. From the nations, remember we talked about this is already a new author, because this is explaining the background to the revolt. The nations that God said don't have relations with them, because they might lead you astray. Okay. Shlomo thought he could overcome that, and he made treaties with them. Okay. And then we sort of exaggerate. He has 700 wives and 300 pilakshim, and they take him astray. Okay. And when Shlomo got old, they say, Niat Shlomo, Nashavi Tuat Levavo. They turned his heart away from God. And it wasn't, his heart wasn't full, complete with God like it was, like David was. Now, then he starts following all these other gods. Who are the gods? Ashtaroth, that god of the Tzidonim, Milcom, the god of Ammon. Okay. And Shlomo did evil in the eyes of God. There might be wordplay with me there, I doubt it though. Bilan below, but maybe, but I doubt it. Now, as if there's Shlomo Bama lechmos shukutz Moav, Baharav Pen Yerushalayim, ulemolech shukutz Ben Amon. He builds places of worship for these gods. V'chein esa lechon neshava nechriot, amakriot nesabchot lalohen, v'aytam from Shlomo, ki natal lebom b'im Hashem, elav nira. Okay? Now, and God tells Shlomo, because you did all this terrible thing, you didn't keep my brit, etc., God's going to take the kingdom away from you. The same wording he tells Shaul about when David's going to take over. We'll talk about that when we get to the ripped coat. The same wording when God splits the kingdom. But it won't be in your days. It'll be in the time of your son. Now, but that, then we'll get to these two kings. We'll go back to them in a minute. Now, here's the key. How could it be that Shlomo HaMelech, remember? Who writes Mishlei, remember? Shlomo Melech, the great king who does so much good. How can you do Avodah Zarah? I'm the same question about Chet HaEgel. What happened? If you're building embassies for your foreign wives and it's part of your political growth, you follow? If I need to help in an American embassy in Jerusalem, right? And a Canadian embassy and a Saudi Arabia embassy, etc. What's going to happen? Officials are going to come and visit. Workers are going to come. Businessmen are going to come. And they need kosher food. Not kosher. They need shrimp. They need their customs. And they need a chapel. And in the airport, I need to make a multi-faith chapel. You follow? And therefore, for his foreign wives, I need to have a place to serve their gods. Not because we're serving their gods, but that's what you do when you're growing now to become this great superpower and you want to make a name for God. In the meantime, I have to sort of put up with their narishkeit, with their gods. And therefore, the price you're paying for having a treaty with Egypt and having a treaty with Ammon and Moab, etc., which now when you're looking at the big picture, oh, look how great things are. Right? The price you pay is I have to sort of accommodate for the religious needs. Okay, what's the big deal? I built a little chapel for their gods. Now the problem is these people come and they need their customs and they meet the Jewish businessmen who they're working with. Oh, and they come Friday night, they come to us to have gefilte fish. And Mitzray Shabbos, we go to their place and watch movies. You follow? There's a cultural price you pay for globalization. The problem every happens. And the question, his ideas are great, but is Shlomo growing way too fast? Which is going to be what I'm getting at is the political reason for the political unrest, because why do we have to do all these building projects for these foreign kings? Who needs them in our city? In other words, I don't mind spending money or working to build God's house and the king's house, but the Milo for all these foreign people, enough is enough. But it's almost like it's a religious revolt. It gets growing too fast. Jerusalem's becoming too cosmopolitan. And even though Shlomo means well, it's almost like these modern Orthodox religious Zionists who think it's okay to have a state and open up Israel to, you know, I'm joking, but you got my point. In other words, the second you start this idea of international relations and being a light to other nations, and you know, and there's a religious value in having a Jewish state, having an Olympic team, and having playing in all the sports events, etc. So you go to their countries, they come to your country, but the players and the people participating in all these events are going to be affected by that culture, which are going to bring people down. Again, but seriously, the problem with the army nowadays, when you want to have Haredim come to the army, so there's a lot of Haredim who really would love to serve, but what are the rabbis saying? The second you join the army, the whole culture there is not religious. So now they're going to try and accommodate them to make it possible. But it's not, there's logic to that refraining from growing too quickly for this international growth. There's a nice idea of being a light to other nations, but you got to do it slowly. And instead of sometimes the same question comes up: is it okay for a Jewish student to go to a non-Jewish university? In other words, if you go to a secular university, is it going to bring you down, or can you come and sanctify God? So it's possible to go to a secular university and be a big Kiddush Hashem. That can happen maybe 10-20% of the time, but usually what happens is that brings people down. And that's always a big question you have when you're giving advice to students where they should go to YU or to a yeshiva or go to a secular university. Same thing, working places and things like that. How much do you open yourself up to foreign cultures? How strong are you to be able to do that? There's a value in going out, but there's also a danger in it. So I'm trying to show you.
Devarim says that they want a king to be Kechol HaGoyim. So it's to include all the Goyim.
Hmm. So that's we talked about that way back. Kechol HaGoyim can mean we want to be like the Goyim Fe.
Not just to be
Kechol HaGoyim. We want to be a nation like other nations, so we can be a light to other nations. Kechol HaGoyim, like Avram being an Avramon Goyim.
Not only positive, to be like them, but to include them, to invite them into our embassies.
Exactly. That's it. It can be something positive. It can be something negative. And that's why the double meaning is built into the words. That you can ask Kechol HaGoyim for good reasons and for bad reasons. That's what Chazal said when the people go to Shmuel and ask for a king. They said there were four groups. This Kenim Shaluk, people ask Kohogan, some people ask for the right reason, some people for the wrong reason. The same thing. People want to go, I'll give a bad example. You want to go to Israel for a year. So people want to go to learn Torah. One thing, want to go to Israel to have a fun time, and have fun for a year and party for a year. So you can do the same act, but come up for different motivations. Now let's get back to our big topic. What I'm trying to show you is that the religious reason, God's punishment for Shlomo, goes hand in hand with the political reason. There's social unrest because there's too much work and too much taxation. You ever hear of a revolt that started with taxation without representation? The Great British Empire getting it started. But, you keep on taxing people, sooner or later they'll revolt. It's such a natural phenomena. And that's what I want to show you. The building project Shlomo is doing with all the great intentions are going to cause social unrest with police. And that's why when the book introduces Yerovam, who's in charge of Kol Seva Beit Yosef, and he's a good worker, that's why he's the head of the Teamsters Union, who's first was tight with Shlomo, but at the end he became friendly with his workers, and enough was enough. So Shlomo can handle it by the time he get to his kid, who didn't grow up, with his, by he got third generation Malchut David. Rehavam was already spoiled and, wouldn't listen to the advice of his, and, that's the story we'll get in chapter 12. So let's go back now and review and finish up. Okay, let me go back now to my shared screen, wherever that was. Share screen, here we go. And we were here. Okay, we did this. Okay, so now you understand why I spent so much time on these first three psukim. Okay. Shlomo building the Milo and closing up Eretz David, if that goes hand in hand with building a house for Bat Baro and the building projects, okay, so that was his revolt against the king because he was in charge of all the workers. Okay. Now, at that time when the revolt's beginning, Yerovam is leaving from Yerushalayim, and Achia Shiloni, the Nabi finds him, and he's wearing a new cloak, right? And both of them are alone in the field. Now, we'll work backwards. Why is it important that both of them are alone in the field? What does that enable? That enables if you're saying you're going to take over a kingdom, you follow? That's what we call it, sedition, I think. They can put you in jail for that. Now, we have political prophets again. Remember Shmuel had to make a cover story to anoint David? Remember he's saying to bring a korban? And God gave him a cover story. Remember what did Shmuel say? Shmuel will hear that I'm doing this and he'll kill me. Even if you're a rabbi and a prophet, you can't go say that you're losing your government, right? And someone else is going to take over. That's seditious against the thing. And therefore, they're alone in the field. Now, the new cloak, which is going to be ripped up, you remember that in a minute. Did that ever happen before where a Navi has a coat and he rips a coat as a sign of a political change? I'm sure you know. Which one? What am I talking about? With Shaul, remember? And Shmuel. When after Amalek, Shmuel comes out. Who ripped whose coat? Remember? Did Shlomo rip Shaul's coat or did Shaul rip Shmuel's coat? Remember the argument?
Yes.
And we have the same machloket here. Who's wearing the Samah Chadasha? Who's wearing the new coat? Now, if you like Gershon, you're like this. Why is this new coat called here a Samah? And that's just a begin. Right? Samah and Shlomo, remember? It's a partial talk about that. The wordplay on the Samah Chadasha with the word Shlomo built into it. It's not that fair. It's extending letters, right? Shlomo and Samah, just a shin and a sin. Now, unclear, right? Asher alav on who? No, it's who's wearing the new clothing? J.D. Vance? Okay, no, I'm sorry, I'm just joking. I'm wearing a new suit because I'm a new big shot. Or is the Navi wearing the new coat? And he brought it to rip. Is the Samah Chadasha a sign that I'm a big shot now? I'm changing my dress because I'm about to revolt. Or is that something that, again, it's a machlok, look in the parshim, it's a great machloket. Okay. What does he do, the Navi? He rips it into 12 pieces. Now, the math there doesn't add up, right? But what happens is 12 pieces for the 12 tribes. And he tells Yerovam, you take 10 pieces. Got it? Yeah. Because God's going to take the kingdom from Shlomo, right? And giving you 10 tribes. And one tribe goes to who? Goes to David. Now, what's wrong with the math here? If there's 12 tribes and 10 go to Yerovam and one goes to David, I'm missing a tribe, aren't I? You understand the math problem? All the parshim talk about it. Okay. God tells Yerovam, you take 10 tribes. I'm going to take the mamlacha from Shlomo. I'm giving you Asara Shvatim. And one shevet I'm going to give to Abdi to David, which will be, what shevet is that?
Binyamin.
Ah, exactly. No, it's that the math is not a problem. It says, obviously, Yehuda is with Yehuda. The one tribe he gets will be Binyamin. Why Binyamin? Doesn't Binyamin belong with Bnei Leah? Isn't Binyamin Yosef's brother? Right? Which makes no sense.
He's got the
unless Binyamin has a history with their neighbors ever since Pelegish Begiva. Okay. So even though they're sometimes people, the closer your relationship, the more you fight. But what's the real reason? Okay. Why is Yamin for the sake of Jerusalem? That's easy. If you know your geography, if Binyamin would have been with Yosef, Jerusalem would have been a border city. Okay? Binyamin has to be with Yehuda. So Jerusalem is not a border city, number one. And number two, Nachat Binyamin is not, Binyamin is Nachat Shechina as well. Remember, it's always, so I need Binyamin to be with Yehuda in order to make Yerushalayim the Mikdash. Okay. Now, why? Because what? Because he left me, remember? And he bowed down to all these different kings. Okay. And they did, he didn't do Yashar Ben Yashem to keep like David. Now, when Chazal talk about how could it be that Shlomo served all this idol worship, what did they answer? Male alav ktuv kilu. In other words, for sure he didn't do that, but it's as though he did it. In other words, he has what's called ministerial responsibility. I'll give you that. Let's say there's a country who, what do you call it, had a terrible security breakdown, you know? And the soldiers weren't doing their job and everything fell apart and there was that part. Is the what do you call it? Is the prime minister responsible? Big question nowadays, right? So he didn't do it, but does he have ministerial responsibility for it? I'm just giving a wild analogy. Nothing with that's a question. Shlomo obviously didn't serve all these other gods. Why would he believe in them? But he did a political move that enabled that to happen. He thought he was doing it for a good reason, but it backfired. Okay? And therefore, you know, Shlomo basically grew too fast, too quickly. Basically, overdid it. He said, "Anir bevelo asor." God said, "Don't overdo it." He says, "I can handle it," which is a classic problem. That, you know, always the one. It's okay. He goes, "I can go to secular college and I'll be fine with it. I can become a millionaire. It won't get to my head." You follow? So all the same things. You have to, you know, but that's a danger of growth. So when Chazal say it's not that he served these other gods, but he has mysterious responsibility, I think it's right on the mark. It's not even a drash. I think that's a pshat. Now, again, but I'm not going to take the whole kingdom from his hand. Why? I'll build this up now. He'll be like what's that, nasi? We'll see the difference in nasi and a melech in a minute. In other words, Machut David will become a Nasi, got it? And the Melucha will go down to Yerovam. Now, I'm going to call that, but it won't be in his time. It'll do it in the time of his son, okay? And we'll see, Yerovam will get 10 tribes. Again, Uvno Aten Shevet Achad Laman Hayot Nir Le David Avdi Koyimim Yerushalayim. That was last week's share. See the centrality of Yerushalayim again? Now, I want to make my key point, which I want to follow through the book. I don't think, I know maybe I'm going out on a limb because I don't think anyone else says this, but I'll try to, I'm not sure I'm right, but I want to suggest it. You take and you'll become king, where everybody, you'll be king over Israel. I want to use the analogy of, again, I'm doing too much modern day Israel politics, but just to get the analogy across. Let's take, I can use France, the same idea. I can have a government that has a nasi, a president, and a prime minister. Now, Americans aren't used to this because you don't have that kind of system. But in Israel, you have a nasi. In a lot of countries, in England, you have a king and you have a parliament. Now, who runs the country in the army? The parliament nowadays, right? What's the king? The king is like an official position. In Israel, the nasi should unify the country. He doesn't run the army. He doesn't make political decisions, but he represents the country internationally, formally. So it could be that God wants a shared kingdom, not a split kingdom. Got my point? And I want to prove it to you. I mean, I guess we'll have to do it more in detail next week. What I want to claim is God wanted Yosef and Yehuda to share the kingdom. Now, Yosef, back in Bereshit, has tremendous ability in working with other nations, right? He's an economic genius, okay? You know, he knows how to run an economy. He knows how to get things done. He knows how to unify. He said, no, Yosef is ideal political leadership, okay? Yehuda is more religious leadership as far as, like, you know, values of the country. We call later tzedek and mishpat and things like that. What did God want? God wanted a shared kingdom where Malchut Yehuda would be in charge of the temple and the values of the Jewish people. Ever? Making sure that the temple's running, the Sheba Levi is doing their job, that there's tzedek and mishpat, like David was famous for. He was in charge of the spirit of the country, the values of the country, and making sure that's going, working with the Nevi'im. And who would be in charge of the army and the economy? That would be Ephraim, which was politically and historically during the first temple period. Ephraim is a big economic power. The 10 tribes, obviously, are much stronger economically than Yehuda. Yehuda is strong, but God wanted to share a kingdom. He didn't want people, he didn't want Yerobam having a separate temple. That's why we're here in the sea is important. David's kingdom would still have power, but not political clout, but rather political influence. But what happened? Too much power for one tribe was not healthy. And there's no way, if you will see later on, what Shlomo divides up the kingdom and funds it, Shevet Yehuda is being too much, is being favored too much. They're not participating enough in the taxation. We'll see later on. When Shlomo divides up the funding for the different tribes to fund all the building projects. And who's getting the brunt of all the taxation? Dafke Ephraim and the northern tribes. Because Yehuda has protection. So it's not healthy that one tribe has so much power. There's a value of a shared kingdom, which goes back to the need for Leah and Rachel. Got it? There's a need for leadership of Yehuda and Yosef. You follow? It's not that it's either Yehuda or Yosef. It's who should be the Bechor? Yosef or Yehuda? Did we say this Tzukim in Divrei Yamim? I'll show you one more time. Divrei Yamim, Aleph, chapter, give me a second. I think it's chapter 5. We're going to go to, here we go. Bible, Chronicles, chapter 5, I think. Okay. Ubnei Ruvain, Bechor Yisrael. Why? Ki hu abchor. He's the firstborn because he was born first. V'chado Yitzu Yavid, Nitna Bechor Tov Lebnei Yosef. Ben Yisrael. Who got the Bechorah? Yosef. Got it? Ulo litiyaches la Bechorah. Ki Yehuda gavar bechav l'negid bimeno v'abchorah de Yosef. Yehuda became negid, the leader. Got it? Yehuda took leadership gavar bechav. But the Bechorah, the double portion went to Yosef. But you see in this pasuk, the shared leadership. Got it? There's leadership of Yehuda. With chasal kol Mashiach bet Yosef and Mashiach of Yehuda. But there's a value here of shared leadership, which I think goes back to why God wanted Yaakov to have two wives. And God wanted 12 tribes, even some from Shvachot. And if you're going to be a model, I'll develop this idea next week, because it's built on the Shir and Sefer Breshit already, that I don't think it's a comedy of errors of Yaakov having 12 tribes. What's my proof? Even Nachor has 12 tribes. Yishmael has 12 tribes, right? The number 12, nations have 12. Remember, Nachor has 8 sons from his wife, from Milcah, and 4 from the Pilgshim. We read that in Rosh Hashanah at the end. He named Yadam Milcah Nachor lebanim lachicha. Remember, there's 8 Shmuel Eli Yadam Nachor the Milcah for Milcah, who Pilgshim Shmuel Ruma, and she had 4 kids. The number 12 happens a lot in Bereshit. It's not by chance, and it seems like God wanted Yaakov to have 2 wives. Otherwise, how did that happen with Lavan? And he wanted why? If we're going to be a model for 70 nations with different flags to work together, and even have different flags, you can have a common goal, and you can work together even though you have different views. It's called pluralism in the ideal sense. We need 12 tribes, each tribe having its own flag of sorts. But working together, if we can have 12 tribes working together, we can be model for 70 nations working together. Now, to be a nation representing God with a model for universal unity, for everyone to call it in the name of God, like we talked about in Eleinu. If we're going to be a model for other nations to learn from, there's a value in our being 12 tribes, not one tribe. There's a value of our having Rachel and Leah. There's a value of Yehuda leadership and Yosef leadership. And they can't be in the same person. It was almost what we talked about in Breshit, if you remember. What Yitzchak was thinking with Yaakov and Esav. Yitzchak was thinking that Yaakov and Esav would both be Am Yisrael. Esav would be in charge of the army and the country, and Yosef would be in charge of education, sitting and learning. But that, no, it had to wait one more generation. Yitzchak had the right idea, but we had to go one more generation because he needed, you know, because Yaakov has to have the hands of Yosef, I mean, the hands of Esav and the voice of Yosef and the voice of Yaakov. In other words, you need the character, you need both characters in Am Yisrael, but that character has to manifest itself with 12 tribes. But our ability to be 12 tribes working together is an ideal model. And therefore, I think what God wanted, that's why maybe that analogy in the beginning, that with the first Luchot and second Luchot, and before the flood, after the flood, and before God, and God wanted a shared kingdom. He wanted Yosef that power and you to have that power. It had to start with Shlomo. Shlomo was bound to grow too fast and go wrong. And then God said, let's share the kingdom together. Now, in the beginning, it had to be in a negative way where Yehuda would be totally downgraded because they went too far, and therefore, Achlok, it won't be forever. But I think God wanted forever was a shared kingdom between Yehuda and Yosef, and they could work together. What's going to be my proof next week? Yerovam's revolt, right, was not his own idea. It was God's idea. What went wrong? His religious reform. Got it? That was, he wasn't willing. There's a famous midrash we'll see next week. Remember the one where God tells Yerovam, me, you, and Ben Ishai will go in Gan Eden together? See the Gan Eden analogy? And then Yerovam asks, who's in charge? Who's on the top? He says, Ben Ishai Barosh. And then Yerovam says, we'll start with this next week. If that's the case, I don't want part of it. That's, the lack of willingness to share power is going to cause a downfall. There was this ideal setup that God wanted. The fall of Shlomo was bound to happen. And God sort of, you know, was going to take advantage of that and try to set up a shared kingdom that could be a model for other nations to learn from. He wanted Yehuda and Yosef to work it out and work together. Instead, it led to civil war. Now, instead of having a value, if I want to do modern times, there's a value in having that's called, let's say, Haredim and modern Orthodox. And without, I don't want to go too far on the spectrum of the 12 tribes. I got in trouble for saying, I can't have an umbrella. I think it's okay. You can have different groups of Jews. If your goal is being a nation representing God, you can have different values of what's the best way to get the job done. I can have liberals and conservatives, and you know, I can have different approaches about how to run your economy, how to run your army, how to tax and things like that. I can have socialists and liberals and whatever you call them, capitalists and things like that. Each idea has value, but can you work together and share ideas with them, and you can grow through those shared ideas. And leadership, and I think there's a value in that shared leadership. And I think that's the motto of Yosef and Yehuda working together. I think that's what God wanted. That's why God sends Achia Shiloni. What falls apart is Yerovam's lack of willingness to share the kingdom with Yehuda. And that's going to bring down Beit Rishon. Anyway, that's my theory for the rest of Sefer Melachim. I'll go over the couple more sources in a minute, but that's the model I want to show you. Again, I'm dealing not on the every parak. I'm dealing at the book level. The split kingdom, I think, wasn't because Shlomo sinned. Shlomo's sin was bound to happen with that type of growth, just like Chatego is bound to happen. Maybe we'll talk about that. I'll continue this next week when we talk about Yerovam's ego. He builds in why the Nevi calls it an ego. And why it's so similar to Chet Ego, where there's a good idea, but you have to have a flood to have after the flood. Got the idea? I have the first luchot need to be broken to get the second luchot. But this model of Yehuda and Yosef sharing your kingdom together and working together, and that'll be the ideal model for other nations to learn from. That was something I think God wanted and could have happened. And Am Yisrael wasn't willing to be able to work together. No, they didn't understand this idea. If you remember the Haftarah we read, I think, Chalom HaPesach from Yechezkel, about what should happen in Beit Sheni, Eitz Ephraim and Eitz Yehuda, and to unite them. But they're both still Eitzim. They're together, but each one has its own identity. Min b'mino in a batel, if you know the halachic analogy. Even though they're working together, that each one keeps their own identity. So I need Eitz Ephraim and Eitz Yehuda, and they can be united. You can have one melech, but each one can have their own leadership, and that's the model we see if we deal safe. Yosef is a leadership model. So is Yehuda, And we need 10 other tribes as well. And you need people who aren't leaders. They're also important. You need followers to get works done. Everyone with their different strengths. You need Shevet Levi. You got it. You need it, but each one has to appreciate the other and not see the other as an enemy. And that was a value that I think I was trying to build, and since it doesn't work out. So next week, let me just check the chat real fast, and then let me see what happened. Chat. And, oh, wait a second. Oh my gosh. Okay, there's the source sheets. Parrots is a trans called the Milo by Devin Kaipan. Okay, very good. I'll send the link maybe next week to the what they just found in Ir David. So it was just on the news today. It says Ahava marrying not just political. Okay. Ahav, okay. I'm not sure, but what Ahav means, like could be he liked the girl, or it could be it says Ahav sounds like love and not just political alliances. I'm not sure whether that's what Ahav means, because Oheva Misa means God chose. And Avat Olam means that you're chosen forever. And choosing to do something, Avat isn't only like, you know, romantic love in Tanakh. It's also a choice of a partnership. Okay. Yeah, Muslim countries like Iran insist on foreigners adhering to their things. Women, okay. Again, you're right. If you demand other dignitaries follow your customs, you can only do that if you're strong enough. But it's one approach. You can always have an approach of, oh, but same thing with your children. How strict are you with the children? If you want to build relationships, you say, you know what, you're okay. And what do you call it? Let's work together. And little by little, you'll see the light of my opinion, or do you force your opinions or your values on other people? What's a better technique of bringing unity? To force it through education. So the Jewish approach, I think, is usually through education and model behavior. But there's also logic to, you know, using political power to get things done.
When Rome do as the Romans do.
Yeah. Okay. I'm saying there's different approaches. It's a club. It's not necessarily the only way to do things. And Nasir is like a lame duck? I'm not sure. And Nasi means he has, and Nasi, we have in Chumash, Asher Nasi Echta, and Nasi is an important person.
Right, but here he says, I'm going to leave you alive, Shlomo. I'm not taking it away from you. I'm going to place you as a Nasi. I'm telling you, Yerovam, right now, you're the king. But yet, Shlomo is still the king. So he's, you know,
and his kingdom is going to remain, but his kingdom will remain forever as long as he keeps his laws. But he'll steal his kingdom, but Yerovam will only get 10 tribes for the sake of Yerushalayim. The question is, Nasi only referring to Shlomo or the kings after Shlomo as well? I think Nasi is referring to the status of Malchut David after the ideal split, which never happened in the end. That's right. Oh, Susanna says that's like the mother-father model, running a family. You need a mother and a father, and only having one, and they're fighting over who's running their family is not healthy. That's very good. That leads to a split kingdom. Okay. Rabbi Shlomo. Okay. Very good. Okay. Very good. Anyway, that's the direction I want to go with. I know it's not, I'm pretty sure it's, I came with the idea a long time ago when Alex Israel had his book launch on the Book of Kings. It was at Pardes. You know, Alex, I'm sure Alex has spoken here. He has a book on kings. So when he did his book launch about 10 years ago, so myself and Yael Ziegler spoke at the book launch, I think. So I presented, Yael presented a totally different approach about the Malchut David being the ideal and it's only temporary. And I presented a different approach where I thought the split kingdom was an ideal and Yerovam missed the opportunity, but it wasn't just a punishment. That's apparent from the beginning. When you have something, when God sets something up and it all falls apart and then it's reset up again, is that always, you know, an afterthought, or is that how you build things? And the pattern of Gan Eden, Gintron, out of Gan Eden, before the flood, after the flood, first Luchot, second Luchot, with all the literal parallels between them, Malchut Shaul, Malchut David. There's something to it about, I call it adolescence of a nation. How do you become an adult? You have to go through adolescence. You need to fall. You can't learn to ride a bike without falling. And that's a process of growth. And so anyway, it's an approach that only I think older people understand. Maybe it's a good way to start, but it's a good, again, I told you, I'm not sure if it's right, but something I want to share with you, and you can later tell me what you think. But I'll try to show it as we go through. Again, it didn't work. So that's the problem. But the question didn't work because it was a bad idea. It didn't work because people are people and they don't know how to share power. I think that's a more eternal message behind it. Okay. Anyway, I have tons more sources. I'll use the same short next week, and then we'll do two. I'll use it next week, and we'll go through all the things a little more in detail about the when the kingdom actually split. So when do we reach when childhood ends? There's childhood of the nation. There's childhood of a person. There's individual children, and there's national. There's nations growing up, and like every nation has its war of independence and starting up, and then has its growth and civil wars, and then there's history. World history works that way. Nations have their own, growth process as well. And go in different directions.
It's just a reference to the childhood's end of the whole human race. That's an Arthur Clarke, very famous sci-fi book. The childhood's end for a human.
Oh, I see. Childhood ends when the human race will end. Mm-hmm. You want to... It's not easy leaving childhood, but it's not called Shmini Atzeret. You can't stay in the sukkah. The sukkah is nice, but you got to get out of there. You got to go back to your house, but that's why you need Shmini Atzeret for the transition. So that's the, that's like college graduation. Are you saying goodbye to college or welcome to, the mature adult life? Okay. Anyway, we'll stop here for today and, next week, I'll add to the source sheet, but the last source we didn't get through today, we'll go back to them next week. And next week, I want to talk about the Chet HaEgel, Chet HaRavam, with Agalim and Beit HaLundan. What was his Havamina and what went wrong? And we'll bring that Midrash we talked about with, what was good about Yerovam and what went bad. What we didn't do, you can look at later on, Yerovam runs, there's all these parallels in chapter 11 between Moshe Rabbeinu and Yerovam, where he runs away to Egypt, the king notes, and he marries the king's, the king of Egypt gives him a wife. He says he wants to go back to his people. He says that you should stay. It's almost the Moshe Nitro story flipped around. And what's there's no doubt there's allusions to it. I think it's more than by chance, but what's the reason for it? What's the message that maybe we'll talk about? But that's more Eun in the book. I want to stay focused on the book level and not so much at the, with the partial level. Okay. Anyway, have a good week, everybody. And, okay. That's commencement. It's maybe not really commencement. Okay. That's what commencement does mean. You're ending something or beginning something. I'm not sure what commencement actually means. I guess it has to do with the comment. Comment there somewhere. Or commence. Is that, what's commencement mean in English?
It means beginning.
It means beginning. Oh, okay. Usually isn't the end of when you graduate is called commencement?
Right. That's called commencement, but commence is to begin.
Ah, so that's the whole word of calling it. Okay. See, I always thought it meant the ending because I always know it's when you graduate. It's called commencement.
Graduation.
Commencement is another word.
That's what you think. That's in graduation and commencement. Okay.
Graduation, but to commence is to begin. So, yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Your point is well taken about that.
Okay. So I learned something new today. Very good. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shavua tov.